Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. On today's show, we welcome Aaron Adams and Liz Crane, authors of the new cookbook, Fermenter, DIY Fermentation for Vegan Fare, from Sasquatch Books. Aaron is owner chef of Fermenter and the new Workshop Food and Drink restaurant in Portland. He grew up in the East Bay, where he entered the local punk scene, joined a group of anti-racist skinheads, and watched a lot of cooking shows on the local PBS station. Aaron started cooking professionally in Seattle, then made stops in Guam, Miami, New York, and Jacksonville, Florida, before landing here in Portland. Liz is a PDX-based food writer and author. Her books include Food Lover's Guide to Portland, Toro Bravo, Hello, My Name is Tasty, Grow Your Own, Understanding, Cultivating, and Enjoying Cannabis, and most recently, Dumplings Equal Love. Liz also co-organizes the annual Portland Fermentation Festival, which takes place this year on Thursday, October 19th. Gregory Gourdet, Top Chef All-Star and owner of Portland's award-winning Khan restaurant, writes, "Fermenter is hands down one of my favorite restaurants in the country. I learn new things in every single recipe of this vital cookbook." Please join us for our conversation with Aaron and Liz, which is already in progress. Aaron and Liz, thanks for joining us in the KVU studios today.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Ken.
Well, Aaron, we mentioned in the intro that you grew up in the East Bay.
Yeah.
Born in Livermore, moved to Hayward, and yep. You found community there in the punk scene in the late 80s, early 90s?
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, especially in Berkeley. I spent a lot of time at a club called 924 Gilman, which was like a $5 a year membership, but pretty cheap shows. And, you know, saw like bands like, you know, like Green Day when they were starting out, wow. And Operation Ivy and Rancid and the Winona Riders and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But just such such awesome acts, all the Lookout record bands and stuff like that I really was into. So, yeah, it was definitely cool to like kind of find a group of other people that were like just as unaccepted by society as I felt like I was.
That's kind of the origin of punk, right?
To
the people who didn't fit into whatever the corporate or the rock culture was at the time.
For sure. And I think that like it was so, street music in general has been so inspirational. And I thank my brother so much because I was sitting around like listening to like Def Leppard and like, you know, hard rock and stuff. And then my brother went to go to work at the Oakland airport loading planes for UPS. And he just met like people that brought, you know, like hip hop and punk and all sorts of stuff. And he'd bring those records home, you know, from Rasputin Records. And I started to like listen to that stuff and then started branching out on my own and then going to shows. And I think it was like, it was cool because, yeah, the music's fun and energetic and cool, but it's also like a lot of questioning of authority and a lot of just kind of like considering like our place and community, competition, community over competition, you know, and like just concerning yourselves with matters of like justice and like, and then all these other things came up, started thinking about like, you know, animal rights and like,
Well, you mentioned in the book you joined an anti-racist group talking about justice, skinheads against racial prejudice, or SHARP.
Right, totally. Sure. So like at that 924 Gilman one night, I remember I was, you know, I'd always been like anti-racist and like it had been like a kind of a big part of my identity growing up. Like it meant a lot to me, but also like, you know, so I was like a little ska kid, you know, I had all my little ska patches on my flight jacket, you know, and I'm like, I was at Gilman, I was walking back to my car and a bunch of these neo-Nazi guys surrounded me, and I won't get into the whole long story, but they gave me a couple black eyes and like beat me up a little bit. And from there, I was just like, man, I need to like kind of do something about this to protect myself was the first thought. And then later on, just kind of like got more active and then eventually moved to like Seattle and kind of like did more stuff up there.
Yeah. I still want to stay in the Bay Area with you.
Yeah.
Maybe something more pleasant than the skinheads.
That's, there's a lot more pleasant.
Yes, almost everything. You talked about watching at the Palace event just a few days ago. You talked about watching cooking shows on KQED, which is the PBS station in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
While your friends were probably into other shows. What was that early attraction for you to food and to preparing? Of course, food shows are all over TV now.
I think that there's definitely a longing for having community and family and family gatherings. You know, we had a lot of that. It was kind of like our family was in bursts, you know, like on a personal level. Like, I love my family very much, but like we were kind of distant from everybody else because of the proximity of where we lived. And, you know, like all my Cuban family was kind of like off in other parts of the Bay Area, and we didn't see them quite as often. And I think my brother and I both felt kind of isolated. And I think that, and then my brother eventually left the house too early. He like moved out of the house when he was like 15 or something to go stay at my grandparents' house.
And that was in Florida?
No, they were in Union City at that time, which is in the Bay Area. But like, I think that there was just this period of time where I was really lonely. And I was also like kind of androgynous, vegetarian, you know, just kind of an oddball at school. So I just didn't have a lot of friends. And so I just kind of had this like longing for this, that kind of community. It's, I think, why I sought out groups like Sharp, but also it's why I wanted to cook, because, you know, cooking were those core memories as a kid of like getting around the table with family and friends and like celebrating, and just such warm and good memories. And I wanted to orchestrate that. So I started to, as a kid, just like put on little meals, and it just kept on going. And as a story I haven't really told anyone before, is something that's kind of unlocked when you're talking right now, is like, I remember just like being a full-on skinhead, like with like, you know, like boots and you know, straight laced, and like my bleachy jeans, and like wearing a Fred Perry and stuff like that, but with a little apron on. And I was like making a fancy meal for a bunch of skinheads at their house, and they're like, "You better fucking clean that up, man!" And like, you know, and like I'm like, "Fuck you guys, you're gonna like this," you know, and just like a bunch of like, it's just such a funny scene, you know. But that was like the culmination for me of like that time in my life for sure.
And being a vegetarian, you mentioned in the book that your mom wasn't. So, to eat the food you wanted to eat, you had to make it yourself.
That was definitely a big part of it. I mean, like my mom, you know, was, you know, one of the first questions when I was like, I was going to be vegetarian is like, you know, can you eat pork? You know?
It was a new concept then.
Yeah, definitely a new concept.
Now, you talked about going to Seattle. That was when you went from amateur to professional chef. And you write that you wanted to be a cook when you saw big guys and Chef White smoking cigarettes by a restaurant dumpster, which would be a great scene in a movie.
For sure.
So that was kind of that punk ethos, too, that attracted you to the profession.
It was another subculture. It was another subculture, you know, and that's a thing I've always liked. You know, I was like, you know, what are those guys doing over there? I've always loved street culture. I've always loved, like, those kind of subcultures. Always been attracted to, like I said, punk skin, hip-hop, you know, all that kind of stuff. So those guys were street tough to me, too. And so, like, and it bore out to be very true. You know, Seattle, definitely. But, like, you know, moving on to other places, like, definitely got more and more, you know, quote-unquote hardcore, for sure.
And you got your start, I read, as a dishwasher at a steakhouse, of all places, for a vegetarian.
Yeah.
How did you move up from dishwasher to cook?
Well, I moved up from dishwasher to my first promotion out of dishwashing was to salad bar manager or you know, whatever, you know, a salad bartender, I should say. And then I got quickly demoted back to dishwasher.
Oh, what happened? You ran out of chickpeas, you know, or something?
Chopping broccoli.
I just was not good at it. And also I had a lot of attitude and stuff, and I wasn't like a very good employee. Yeah. When I was a dishwasher, I would like basically, you know, if I got sent a burnt pan, I would just like throw it in the trash, or like I didn't want to wash a bunch of stuff, I'd throw out silverware, you know. So I was like a terrible, terrible employee. I eventually quit that steakhouse by lying to them and saying that I accidentally cut my thumb off and couldn't come to work that day. But they wouldn't send me my check. They made me come to work to pick it up. So I just wrapped my hand in gauze and like came
in. Put a little ketchup underneath.
Totally. But yeah, it was. And then, you know, I was really lucky. My good friend Bryce Lamb, who was like kind of in the periphery of the skinhead scene, he was like in the scooter scene, you know, because we all rode Vespa scooters and stuff. And he got me a job at his place doing dishes and working pantry. And you know, I remember that job, $5.25 an hour, no tips, just like, you know, slogging away. Like, and but I got to make my first desserts. I got to make pastas. I got to do all the pantry cooking. I just learned a lot of stuff there. And it kept that fire burning for sure, and wanting to keep on going, you know. And I tried going to culinary school in Seattle, but because I was a punk kid, I literally got scabies while I was at school because I was sleeping on couches and stuff. And so then
they kicked you out, or
no? I just like didn't go back because of embarrassment, because I had like a, you know, huge like rash or whatever, like all over my my torso. Super gross. Because I was like sleeping in my car or like sleeping in couches of I'd show up at a punk house and like walk in and like everyone's like jaundiced and yellow eyed and I'd be like, okay, see you guys later. Gonna go sleep somewhere else. So yeah, it was a little tough back then, but yeah, it turned out okay.
And yet you did go from omnivore to vegan, and you tell a really beautiful story in the book of how that happened. It involves a destructive fire, move to a new house, and an armoire.
Yeah, you know, when I was a young guy back in Livermore, you know, we lived on Martin Avenue, and I remember I was out with my grandparents and my mom, and we came home, and the house was on fire, and there was a big crowd, and, you know, the house, whatever wasn't destroyed by fire was destroyed by the water hoses, and the house was just, you know, it was a loss, and we lost, you know, family photos, and it was just, like, a really traumatic kind of, like, it definitely, like, screwed with my brain a little bit, and we definitely went, had to like live in a hotel for a little while. And then when we moved into a new house, later, my mom had some like family pieces of furniture, like this armoire, and you know, they're ginormous things. And I remember like wheeling it in with probably my brother or something on a hand truck. We set it down, and when it landed on the ground, like, you know, because it's not like a perfect piece of furniture anymore, like the door creaks, and it creaks open right into my face with this mirror. And I was just like, kind of like suddenly when I wasn't like ready for it or something, like suddenly confronted with my face. And I saw my eyes like kind of like constricting and dilating and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, oh. And there was something that just kind of epiphanally happened there where I was just like, oh, like I'm alive. I'm this thing. So are these other things. And I just made this connection right there where I was just like, yeah, I can't. And I just stopped eating meat, you know, right then. And I didn't go like full vegan. I still eat cheese, but I eat like rennetless cheese or blah, 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 blah. I tried to figure out, you know, and like learn along the way from there.
Well, Liz, I wanted to get to you. Maybe start talking about fermentation and its history. And this is a topic, of course, you know very well from your own work and your interests. Can you talk a little bit about the fermentation process? What's involved? It's a chemical reaction.
You can go really deep and complicated with all the different types, or you can just simply say it's controlled rot. So it's basically, you know, I mean, like your compost bin there, that's fermentation is happening in there, in your trash can, in your garbage disposal. That's not a very appetizing way of talking about it, though. So what the fermentation that's happening with the different yummy foods and drinks in part one of the book, we're doing those with either salt, so a just dry salt and cabbage, and you're making sauerkraut, or you're making a brine, and then you're making the book's sour pickles, or you're using a SCOBY, aka a mother, and you're making kombucha. Or so you can use cultures to make ferments like those, or Aspergillus orze to make the koji rice in the book. Or you can just use salt and get delicious things like the hot behind hot sauce in the book. So it's basically a transformative process that's breaking down texturally the food that you're fermenting and then making it more acidic, making it more delicious, more nutritious a lot of times too.
And it preserves the food. So
more shelf stable.
It actually has a long history in cultures all over the world. You could say that humans wouldn't be here. We wouldn't have survived without it, or certainly wouldn't have thrived without it.
Yeah. Pre-refrigeration. I mean, if you weren't, you know, salting and dehydrating and fermenting all of the surplus from harvest time, then winter's going to be pretty rough. You know, now we do it because we love the flavors and we love the foods, oftentimes for us in the city in Portland, Oregon. But I mean, there are still lots of parts of the world where it's very needed in terms
right,
of sustenance.
Right, where they don't have as much access to refrigeration and freezers.
Yeah.
And not only the delicious aspect of it, but there's a health aspect. I know, Aaron, at the Powell's event, you mentioned you threw a party for your grandmother's 99th birthday.
101st.
Oh, 101st.
Yeah. Don't shave off years.
Right. So 101. And you asked her secret of longevity, and she said, keep fighting every day and drink pickle juice.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So it must work.
Yes. My Nana, she's from Prussia originally and recently revealed to us all. I don't know why this took 100 years for her to let us all know, but that her family was Prussian Jewish. And so she still makes kohlrabi pickles and all sorts of stuff like that, like at her age. But she's, you know, she's a marvelous, wonderful person. And I mean, she's the light of my life, honestly. And I how lucky am I to be like almost 50 years old and I still have my my grandmother around? It's like unbelievable.
Oh, it is.
Very lucky.
Yeah, yeah, I grew up in a Jewish home and we ate a lot of pickles and also pickled herrings.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, she loves pickled herrings.
From those
she
cultures. Yeah. They needed it.
For sure. And so she's always exposed us to all like those kind of foods. And she's just a marvelous person. But yeah, the fact is that she, I think one of the reasons why she's so healthy, she doesn't like, she does homeopathic, acupuncture, all alternative medicine. Like she's way beyond, you know, way ahead of her time.
Well, that's amazing here for someone who's 101.
She's never had a surgery in her whole life.
Incredible.
She hardly goes to the doctor. And I'm not trying to say this is a good idea, but I'm just saying it's worked for her. She smoked cigarettes for 65 years, and she drank and did everything else that she wanted to do. But I think that's another secret is that she does whatever that she wants to do.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, she just like she's just an incredible person. So.
Well, you have some of those genes, so that bodes well.
I hope to God I have. Enough of them.
Yeah. Now, Liz, let's go back to when you and Aaron first met. I think it was 2009, and you were a food writer for Willamette Week?
Yeah, I was tasked with the great task of reviewing Aaron's first restaurant in Portland, Portobello. So it was a vegan Italian restaurant that was kind of a moonlighting gig in Aaron's brother Jeremy's coffee shop, Cellar Door. And it was fantastic. Everything that I ate was so delicious and complicated. And I'm an omnivore. I had a couple years in high school where I was vegetarian, but I eat everything. And I didn't miss any of the like meat or dairy or seafood that wasn't on the menu. And when I did restaurant reviews, my favorite part was after the fact, after visiting the restaurant a few times, talking with the chef and getting the backstory and maybe other people at the restaurant as well, depending. But I just was really taken by how DIY the whole endeavor was. And, you know, it was Aaron was using like a reach-in Coca-Cola cooler for like most of. So it was like very fresh. Everything had to be very fresh. There wasn't a huge walk-in. You know, working with what they had. And I know like you and Jeremy did a whole like HVAC system that was
We built our own hood.
Yeah.
Well, that's very DIY. Yeah. Well, you basically took over his coffee shop at night, right?
It's yeah. Totally.
What would be a pop-up today?
On a side note, I have to say about the hood.
Yeah.
Like I had worked at a machine shop right before then, because when I first went vegan, I worked in a machine shop for a little bit. And I went back and used the pantograph and had like a little sign that said suck a door that we were going to like put on the hood. And then and when we called the Ansel system guy and said like, hey, can you put a fire suppression system? He's like, what the hell is this thing? I'm like, I don't know. It's here already. Is the hood that was here? And he's like, okay. And
so grandfathered it in.
And the fire chief came in and he was like, what the hell is this thing? He goes, I don't know. It has a fire suppression system.
And you passed.
Yeah, we passed.
And it must have been a really good review that Liz gave you because you mentioned at Powell's that you still have the clipping.
Yeah, it was a great review, and it's great. It's like a little besides the review, like the photo was great because. It just like reminds me of that like little room. I mean, the whole kitchen was about the size of this room that we're in right now. So it was about 10.
This is a small studio, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So about 10 by 10.
Wow.
And you said, we had a table from IKEA. We had a six burner stove and a Coca-Cola cooler. That was about it.
But just seeing like that kind of like innovation and deliciousness coming out of such a small, very resourceful.
Yeah.
And that all has translated into this book too. I mean, there's just like we give a lot of ideas for DIYing everything from like your home incubation chamber for fermenting to X, Y, and Z. But that's when we first met. And then through the fermentation community in Portland, we've just known each other ever since then. Fermentation festival, et cetera. Yeah.
And Portobello, I think, Aaron, was your first restaurant.
Second restaurant.
Oh, what was the first?
It was called...
Oh, right. First in Portland.
First, I had one in Florida called The Village Store, and then it later was called Spontanee.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was like a...
Was that vegan also?
No, because I was not vegan then. I didn't get to being vegan, because I became vegetarian, then I went omnivore for years, and then I became a vegan in like 2002 or 2003.
Right when you moved here, right?
Right when I moved here,
Yeah.
And then let's get to Fermenter. There's a great story in the book about how you started that. It involves a disagreeable landlord, a small vegan restaurant you ran called Farm Spirit.
Yeah.
and the pandemic enters into it too, as it enters into all our lives now.
Yes. So that story. So we had a landlord who, if you're listening, fuck you.
I'm going to have to beep that.
Oh, well, that's all right.
I think I'll get the idea.
Yeah. I just had to throw that in.
Right.
Yeah. But no, I'm sure he's a fine guy. I think, you know, it's just, you know, landlords sometimes, you could have disagreements with landlords. It happens. I'm sure he's, as a human being, he's a fine human being, but whatever. So he, you know, he wanted me to have the shop be open to the public. What had happened is that we had Farm Spirit in 1414 Morrison Street. It's now Mama Dute. And then we moved over to the corner of 14 from Belmont where Roost used to be. And we kept the old shop at where Mama Dute was. We kept it there to use it as a fermentation lab, basically. And also we had a good oven in there, which is still there, I hope. So we used to use that for doing baking and pastry and stuff. But long story short, the landlord's like, hey, you know, you can't just use this as your fermenting shop. You have to have it like open to the public. And, you know, I'd prefer that. And so I said, okay, sure. And so then I put this fermenter logo that I had this guy, you know, draw out to make it like this metal logo. And then, you know, I put four seats in front and, you know, said, you know, oh, we'll do a 3-course tasting at lunch. You
for
know,
just four diners.
Four diners. So we do like maybe 8 covers a day, you know, and it was like, oh, cool. I'll just work on ideas here and just kind of fool around. And we just did like a lot of tempeh heavy dishes. And people were like, whoa, we like tempeh. Which is too bad that it took that for people to like tempeh, because there's so much great tempeh, you know.
I am a big fan of tempeh, and yeah. I've had some bad ones and some extremely
I think that people just aren't exposed to it enough. And I think it's also hard to compare like a tempeh that's made on a large scale that's vacuum sealed. And there's, I mean, if you've ever had tempeh that's never been inside a refrigerator before, it's just like a different animal, you know. So I'm sure like folks in Indonesia get to enjoy that all the time. I wish that we could hear more. A lot of the tempeh made here is made by, you know, really... It's you should look at some of the, I mean, I'm sure you've seen like the tempeh book.
Yeah.
It's like, it's awesome. Like it's basically centers around like places like Serrata and stuff like that. And like the pictures are amazing because it was like made in the 70s. It's just like, they literally have these like hand-drawn pictures of like how to do production with people in the pictures. And it's all like, they're all like got headbands on and like bell bottoms and they're all like hippied out.
I haven't seen that. I thought you were talking about Kirsten's. Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
So I'll show it to you a little
bit. Yeah, I want to see it.
Yeah, so like, you know, there's a lot of really well-meaning people making tempeh and doing some really good stuff, but I think it's lacking a little bit. It's a little, sometimes a little dry, sometimes it's just a little, I don't know. I think that we could work on it a little bit.
I feel like I got into tempeh right before working on this book, and like all of like the burger patty with the black lentils and the millet, it's almost fluffy. And you don't get that like almost fluffy feeling with most of the kind of bricks that you get at the grocery store.
Yeah, I would describe it's it like, as bricks.
I think it's the, really I think dense.
The problem with making tempeh on a larger scale is that, so when you're making tempeh, you have to really be careful about moisture. So that means you have to make sure that your cook is squared away. Like you can't have your cook be like too far gone, or it's going to hold on to, it's going to have a, it's going to be too soft a texture. It's going to hold on too much moisture. It's going to be too difficult to remove that liquid. There's like lots of issues. And I think that it's easier just to kind of do a slight undercook to a point where it's like.
Of the beans.
Of the, substrate that's like not super, it's not as delicious to me.
Yeah. Well, so, when you describe the process in the book, it's kind of like a mad scientist experiment. There's mold spores that are used to knit together the main ingredient, which could be soy, could be beans, legumes.
Sure.
And then it involves acidifying, inoculating, and incubating, which are words you don't normally associate with food.
Right.
So
well, you do. Just
now
you
I do. Yeah, I know.
But,
I do now.
I mean, you think about the way that folks did it traditionally, like Indonesian tempeh is made with black lentils and they're fermented through
soybeans.
Black soybeans.
Yeah.
And then they are given a lactic acid bacteria ferment at first. They do a hot soak. And then they let it soak and sit there till like a biofilm covers all of it. It's a little slimy. It has like kind of a smell. And then it's acidified somewhat there. And then they proceed. And how they modify that in this country is, you know, in most of the production elsewhere outside of Indonesia or in this country too, they usually acidify by using like acetic acid powder or lactic acid powder or vinegar. It's not actually completely necessary to do that to make tempeh, but the point is to acidify the substrate at first in order to inhibit bacterial growth. Because what you're doing with any of these ferments that you'll find in the book is like we're talking about is like setting up environments. And part of setting that environment is this, just creating like a space for the thing that you want to be dominant or the things you want to be dominant to be able to thrive while other things aren't. So if you go to the health department and you're like, hey, I'm going to like cook beans and then I'm going to hold them in the temperature danger zone, which is between 40 and 140 degrees for 24 to 36 hours, they would go tell you to like, you know, well, you don't do that. That would be the nice way they'd say
that'd
that.
That'd be the nice.
It would turn out toxic? Or?
Well, no. So like if you go to, so and during like OHA, Multnomah County Health, you know, they say you cook beans, you can hold them in that temperature zone between 40 degrees and 140 degrees. So either you have to hold it really hot or you have to hold it below a refrigerator, right? And it has to be that temperature because those are temperatures where bacterial growth doesn't happen in the same rate. That is like toxic and horrible. So if you like cook, say if I have a restaurant and I cook some beans that I'm going to serve like as like beans and rice, and I hold it at like 80 degrees or 90 or 120 degrees or something like that for like 7-8 hours, you could be like really like creating a listeria intoxication issue. So like that could be something that would give somebody a tummy ache, make them have some diarrhea, that kind of stuff. So it's like not what you want to do. So then you're like, okay, I'm going to cook beans and I'm going to hold it for 36 hours at this temperature, right? The difference is yes, you've acidified it at first so that you're like going to stave off like initial bacterial growth. But secondly, you've introduced this mold spore set of Aspergillus or Rhizopus oryzae or Rhizopus oligospores or both. And when you do that, you know, that knits together and takes hold and it becomes dominant and it like repels other things from like taking hold. So really what you're trying to do is like, let me create this exact environment where the cook is well enough. Like if I tell the guys whenever they're doing a project for the first time to think about the extremes. So I say like, okay, what would it be like if you took beans dry and then you just threw spores on them and threw them in the incubator so they wouldn't do anything, right? Okay, what if you like cook them until they're like puree and then you add them and you put them in, it would make a mess, right? So then like we start there and we whittle our way down towards that middle place where it's actually gonna work. And where it's gonna work is where it's cooked enough that the starches are gelatinized and therefore accessible for the mycelium to use as fuel so that it does its thing, but not cooked so far into puree that you do not have any physical space between the substrate that the mycelium can move in. Because if I just have like a solid block of paste and I put the spores, it's just gonna grow on the outside. And if the water activity is too high, that's bacterial growth. So when you do stuff like this, like you can follow the instruction in the book, but I also highly suggest that everybody like kind of like sit and ponder and think and do their own research and have conversations with us and other people. Go to our workshops, go look at, you know, talk to other people and start to like, or go into a Reddit group or something like that and just like try to understand the whys. Because if you want to DIY, you have to understand why, mm-hmm. right? And like, if you don't understand why, then you're just following rules. And like, I think that
it's not very punk.
It's not very punk. And it's also not going to allow you to leave whatever you've taught there. So you're like, oh, I'll make black lentil and millet tempeh forever. Well, maybe you want to make mung bean tempeh, or maybe you want to make hazelnut tempeh, or maybe you want to make, you know, whole cauliflower ferment, or, you know, like whatever. Mm-hmm. You have to like, the book is there to give you guidance at the beginning, but literally like the challenge is like, be okay with failing a lot and screwing stuff up and taking notes and looking to see what happens so that you can move on and do stuff that's your own. And then when you start doing that, then everybody can like, then we're talking about signing up for Liz's fermentation festival and bringing a cool project.
Yeah.
You know, and like, and sharing and building community with other people. And like, and the more connections and community and exchange of ideas and sharing and everything like that, the more, I don't know, the more awesome it is.
Hey, you could tell from the knowledge and everything you just told us, you learned all that through the DIY approach, through experimentation, learning
and
from
community.
Your successes and mm-hmm. your failures.
Yeah, for sure. And also incredible community. Like the fact that like a person like Jason White, who is like the head of the Noma Lab, I reached out to him and I'm like, hey, I'm working on this thing, blah, blah, blah. And not only has he like shared with me like his thoughts and feelings on it, but also thousands of pages of documents with great. Like knowledge. And I'm just like, to have that accessibility because the generosity of sharing knowledge among people, that's why we want to do the book. And that's why we wanted to do these kind of conversations, is just to continue to have space to like share knowledge. All this gatekeeping on all these things is ridiculous, because honestly, like, craft and the craft that we do, the whole purpose of it was to like continue, it's to continue culture. And so like any sort of gatekeeping around it and like just like extreme commodification of like these kind of craft projects is, in my mind, immoral.
Yeah.
And for us to be human and to be ethical, we need to like share and talk and build community.
Well, that DIY approach kind of goes back to punk, where instead of listening to corporate rock like Def Leppard, you know, start your own band.
Right.
Yeah.
You mentioned at Powell's, instead of eating an Impossible Burger, go make your own vegan burger.
For sure.
Yeah.
I mean, what happens when you keep on handing keys over to corporate? Then they have every lock and every door, and you can't turn anywhere without seeing it. So then suddenly you're like, cool, my choice is Impossible or Beyond Burgers. Or, you know, so I'm going to go to every restaurant is going to have it, and then think about what that looks like. Okay, so then those products are made with X. So now we need an overabundance of X, whether it's palm oil or
soy
or whatever. So now we need to like have monocultures in order to support that. And then it just goes, you know, just think it back and just keep on exploring back how it goes. It's just insane. Like then we have like totally destabilized economies. You know, I'm like being like a little extreme maybe, but like think about like you put a, you know, everything comes from the same bread basket, and that bread basket can only be in these regions. Then suddenly you have like all of this agricultural intensity here. You have destruction of like forests, you blah, blah. I mean, it gets like that. I mean, that's what it is. And so what you do is that you just try to like utilize local, which is awesome because of that. You have more diversity, and then regional identity and bioregional identity in like the food that you're making. I mean, like it's just... it's so awesome. I think one of the coolest things I see is like watching people come from other places in the world and bring their ideas and bring their food and then modify it by using local ingredients. That's like so synergistic and so beautiful and such a wonderful example of how humans adapt and move in culture and food.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about, the restaurant just celebrated its fourth anniversary.
Yeah.
So, again, your approach, experimentation, DIY, how has it evolved in those 4 years?
From the restaurant?
From when you started, 2019, just before the pandemic.
I don't think an evolution is the right way I would express it. I think it's been a little bit, it's been unstable. I think that's fair to say. I think that we've had a lot of challenges. I'm a, you know, pretty emotional person, so I react. I think part of that reaction has been what kept us here for 4 years, but also I think it's like also pretty tiring. You know, we're constantly like trying to change and figure out the right path. And I think that path took us into a place where we were like getting to like this level of simplicity, and I think it's partly because of the fact that we were like pretty burnt out and tired. But just recently, I think we've definitely recaptured a huge spark. I think the book was a huge part of that. I think that there's some other factors too that just like played into us like kind of becoming more cohesive as a group. And I think that we've refined our group into a people that all have the same ethic. And I've just been seeing like a real electric spirit over at Fermenter. The esprit de corps is really high right now. And I can't say that's always been that way. There's been ups and downs at Fermenter for sure. But like right now, the place that we're at right now, we're all getting fired up about making seasonal and local food. And I feel like we're kind of getting back to that identity that we started off with. I think for a while we've tried out like, oh, we're going to do lots of like a little bit fancier food. And then like, oh, we're just going to focus on burgers. And then, you know, we've tried a lot of stuff out. And I think that, you know, that can create some like friction internally and externally with like customers are like confused about what we're bringing to the table. But I think that if people can be patient and realize that we are still, you know, 4 years is a very young company, that they can see that like where we're at now, I think that we're finally hitting our stride and finally hitting some maturity.
Have you found a similar change in the customers and the diners, more open maybe to vegan food and fermented food? I know there's a whole movement towards plant-based now. not just for health, but also for the health of the planet. And it also has something to do with climate change.
I read
that plant-based is much better for our environment.
I mean, I think that's fair to say. I think that sometimes those statements are overstated a little bit about like the effect, because agriculture is still very damaging in any regard. I think that if you are growing primarily for human beings, you kind of skip a step of having to grow food for animals and then grow those animals for food and that water resources and stuff like that. So I think that there's truth to that. I do think that it's important that as vegans or people who make fermented foods or anything like that, that you don't make false claims. And I think vegans have a tendency, like, sorry to say this, but have a tendency to overstate the impact that they make.
And, yes, I've known several vegans.
Yeah.
They tend to moralize.
Moralize a lot.
I don't think that convinces other people. You're kind of on the defensive right away.
For sure. And I think that we have to like draw people in rather than to try to, you know, kind of just like wag fingers at people. Because, I mean, here's my take on that. I believe in the tenets, but okay, here we are at a place. Donald Watson started like the Vegetarian Society in the UK in like the early 20th century. Before that, there was like traditions of vegetarianism and veganism in all over the world for many, you know, for millennia, you know. But in the Western world, not so much. And it's clear to say, I think it's not a controversial thing for me to say that we are heavily very westernized place here in Portland, Oregon, and in the United States, right? That's not controversial to say. Yes, it is a multicultural society for sure, but like we are very much influenced by what the Western world. And so that idea of vegetarianism is much younger. So it is difficult, whether you're talking about this issue or other social issues, you need to have, like, I think personally that you need to have a little bit of patience with people because you have the momentous force. You have the momentous force of the diesel train that's, you know, powerfully going down the tracks of history of this, just this momentous force just driving down of eating animals, of living in like a binary world, you know, all these kind of like things that like. And then we're like, hey, we have these new ideas, like, stop, you know, and the train doesn't stop right away. And so, like, I think that the ideas are right and they're correct and they're where we need to go. But, like, we need to realize that, like, people aren't just going to, like, the train can't stop that quick.
Hey, like, fermentation, it's a slow process.
For sure. And it is a slow process and it's a transformative process, but you have to set up the right environment.
Well, Liz, I want to list a few of the recipes in the book, which sounds so good. At the restaurant, one of the most popular items is the almost famous fermenter burger. There's a beautiful picture in there, the cheesy Jojo Supreme with tempeh bacon. There's a BLET, which is tempeh bacon, lettuce, shio koji glazed eggplant and tomato on a sourdough bread. Koji beet Reuben from your hippie days when you worked more hippie-centered restaurants, Aaron. And you also described that as the closest you get to a proper deli sandwich. Mm-hmm. So it's an unfair question, perhaps, but do you have a favorite, maybe a go-to when you visit Fermenter or make something on your own from the book?
Yeah, so part one is all the ferments, and then all of those recipes are in part two. So the dishes that you make with them. I think the koji beet Reuben is my favorite, but I vacillate between that and the burger, and both are so rewarding and fun to make at home. There are a lot of components to them, but the koji beets, if you've never made anything with koji, are magnificent. I mean, you're salting, you're dehydrating, you're smoking, you're incubating, you're doing all these steps. And then it's just, I mean, a Reuben sandwich. I had a dog named Reuben. It's my favorite sandwich. I mean, I like a lot of different sandwiches, but yeah, so that one. And then if it's a ferment in part one of the book, that's really hard too, but I just go by what I make the most often, which is two part, the spicy jardinera and then the hot behind hot sauce. So that has a funny name.
But there's a story behind that too.
Yeah, it's a good story.
No pun intended.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when you walk around a kitchen, you say things like corner, if you're walking around a corner, or sharp knife, you know, if you have a sharp knife in your hand, or, you know, behind, if you're walking behind. And I like to give, you know, especially my guy, Josh, our head fermenter, you know, when he walks through with a knife and he says, sharp knife, I'm always like, yeah, right. But like, yeah, I hope, sorry, Josh. And then, but like, if you're walking with something hot behind you, you always say hot behind.
And, like, yes, I could see how that could be construed differently.
Right, right. And so that, as a kid, you know, I'd always be like, you know, like, oh, thank you. Yeah. Right. But it's not, but yeah, that's our silly a restaurant joke. There you go. Ba-dum-bum.
Now, where the cookbook got its birth, and Liz, you're one of the organizers of this, the annual Portland Fermentation Festival, a.k.a. Stinkfest. And that went on hiatus during the pandemic, but it's back?
It's back, and we're so excited. It's Thursday, October 19th at EcoTrust. That's our festival home. And we are welcoming up from Southern Oregon, Kirsten Shockey, who is just so amazing. Yeah. And she's our honorary guest speaker. So the first hour of the festival, Kirsten will, you know, take the stage and talk to us all about various ferments that she's excited about and maybe do a little demo. It's a place, the festival, where you come to talk to one another. It's non-transactional. You are not allowed to spend any money once you enter the festival, which is so unusual for food and drink festivals. It's usually like a place to, you know, be sold to and to buy things. And we're all about sharing cultures, so you can get a kombucha SCOBY, bring a kombucha SCOBY, bring a bottle of, you know, your homemade berry kefir in your backpack and share it with someone else who's brought their ginger beer.
That's what Aaron was talking about. You could bring your own projects.
It's really fun that way. It's how I met Nat West of, you know, rest in peace, Reverend Nat Cidery, which just closed.
You just wrote kind of a nice eulogy in Facebook about them. They're closing down.
It's just a place that the festival is a way of bringing, like Aaron said, this fermentation community together. And it's very diverse. And each year, it's just always so surprising by, you know, how many. I think of fermentation a lot of times as cultural preservation. Mm. And it's a way of, you know, we've had so many people travel to our festival from Japan to be a part. And by the way, in Fermenter, there are a lot of really great Japanese ferments like the chickpea miso, koji rice, etc. But yeah, thank you for asking about that. We're really excited about it. Of course, Aaron is going to be there for Fermenter.
He'll be tabling.
Yeah,
and you've had big celebrities in the fermentation world before. Mm-hmm. David Zilber.
Of Noma.
Was Sander Katz there?
Sander Katz was at our inaugural. He helped us kick off the festival. I mean, he's the reason why I started the festival with friends in 2009,
he's
quite
the
frankly.
For everything.
For so much, yeah. He's how I got into fermentation.
Kind of
and
the godfather
so
of fermentation.
Yeah. But yeah, it'll be so fun, and thanks for mentioning it. We're excited after 3 years of not having the festival, but very kid-friendly. Children 12 and younger get in for free, and there's a starter, barter, and adoption area where you can, like I was saying, pick up those like water kefir grains or pick up that vinegar mother and come home with recipes and talk to the makers and learn about all these ferments. I don't know what Aaron's bringing for Fermenter yet.
Either.
We're weeks away, but something delicious.
So if you have the cookbook, Fermenter Cookbook, you can get a head start by getting some of the ferments instead of making your own, getting them at the festival, and then going on to the dishes, part two of the book.
It's a big, big world that you can get into there. And like, you know, just like anything, you can geek out on it super hard. But it's just like, I mean, I'm excited for anybody to start getting involved in fermentation projects at their home. It's just such an enhancing thing. And I can't wait if like, cross your fingers, me and my wife have a kid, like we're planning on doing. The idea of just being able to sit there like a little kid and like teach them how to make, like, you know, pickles and things like that. Just seems like such a, I mean, that's going to be like where I'm at, like peak, like happiness for sure. Yeah. I'm looking forward to that.
I love that with my niece and nephew. We always do home fermented sodas when I go home for Christmas to Cincinnati. And then we do sauerkraut, and it's fun. It's so fun for kids.
Yeah.
Because it's constantly transforming every day. It's like a holiday every morning because you get to go run into the kitchen or wherever you have your ferment. Like, how did it change? What's it taste like? Is it bubbly now? Like,
and I'd say too, if whether you get our book or another book on fermenting, like any of Kirsten's books are like insane.
Kirsten's are great.
Kirsten's books are insane. Like, if whatever book you decide to get into, or however pathway you get into doing fermenting, or if you have like a cultural like heritage of doing fermenting, like, bring it to your kids because it's such an amazing generational, a coming together of generations and bridging like ancestors to that. And also just like, if you want your kids to eat that food, it turns out that if you get your kids to cook food, they'll eat it a lot more readily. Oh, yeah. So like, you want your kids to eat broccoli, show them how to like cook broccoli, you know?
And totally.
By the way, there's really cool, if you need that resource, there's some really cool chef knives that are made just for children that are available. I think that Portland Knife House has them, but you can definitely get them online too.
What makes a child safe chef knife?
They don't have a point. They're shorter and smaller handle, but they still have like a profile for chopping. Uh-huh. And yeah, they're just a little bit less dangerous for a kid. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned your wife and your home. I before we go, I wanted you to talk a little bit about Jenny. She's a nurse. She started as a pastry chef.
Yeah.
And had a big influence on Fermenter, both the restaurant and the book.
Yes.
She's gluten-free. Yes. And the recipe that closes the book is her sunshine cookie. Sunshine is her nickname.
Yeah.
From her Grateful Dead days, I guess.
Right.
And you describe this as a super hippie, energy-packed and gluten-free cookie that's also over-the-top satisfying.
Yes. I was playing around with a cookie I wanted to have, and Jenny was just like, "Oh, I can give you a recipe. We're just opening up Fermenter, and we haven't changed it. It's been the same recipe ever since. The only thing that I changed about it is instead of like the milk that she had, you know, the like oat milk or whatever she had in it, we started using whey that was left over, cashew or hazelnut whey from making vegan cheeses, as a byproduct using that, and it turned out really good with them. Yeah, I mean, I closed the book out talking about Jenny and what she does. And I think that, you know, it kind of goes into my feelings, you know, in the book, a little bit my feelings about how our culture kind of treats different types of professions. And, you know, certainly I think it's fair to say that people in our profession in cooking don't get remunerated correctly at all. I mean, like people, I mean, I can talk about how great, you know, I pay people, but it's garbage compared to like the regular population. Like we're talking, you know, people get paid well relative to our industry, but our industry does not pay people well enough.
And Jenny is a nurse. She's luckily, not paid as much as she deserves.
I mean, she doesn't either, but luckily, you know, luckily we have her paycheck because mine wouldn't pay the mortgage. Let me just say that. So thank God for our relationship. She allows me to be the dirtbag I am, which is great. But like, I think that the thing that's important though is like when you start talking about like chefs and things like that, like I think it's a little bit silly about how our society has gotten kind of like this kind of like obsessiveness with like putting chefs up on a pedestal, because at the end of the day, we're just like doing a service job. And I mean, I'll take it, like, if it helps business, you know, all the press that they
people celebrity give, chefs.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. Like, if they want to give us, like, some attention, you know, I can't say no because we need people to come in and eat. And that's a great way for people to be exposed to our business. But at the same time, I'm like, man, can't you guys put, like, the great nurses in town on the front covers and stuff? Because at the end of the day, what my wife does and the way that she's, like, literally saved lives – and she works in mother baby, so she saves babies' lives. Like, I can't compare my job to that. And I think that's been also being with Jenny has been incredibly humbling for me insofar as like I kind of like would freak out about things that are pretty petty and small. Like, I got a bad review or somebody like didn't like a sandwich I made or something. You know what I mean? Like, it's just in the scheme of things, like nobody died, everything's fine.
Right. It's a little different than losing a child.
Yeah. I mean, a lot, yeah, obviously a lot different. And like, so having that, being exposed to that all the time, just kind of like reminded me that like, I'm not a big deal and that like what she does is a big deal. And that's why we had like a sign off in the book basically is like an homage to like healthcare workers, especially for like, you know, what those people did for us during COVID. Yeah, it's just unbelievable. So to me, all those people and what they did, like we can never forget, like the contribution that the healthcare workers, service workers, certainly grocery store workers, all that stuff, but like healthcare workers, especially sitting on the front line in fear. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, blessings to them forever. And like, you know, my heart's always going to be big for all those people, big time.
There's one more thing I wanted to get to because you opened up another restaurant recently next door to Fermenter. It's called Workshop Food and Drink. And Aaron, you said the initial idea was to have a cocktail bar with a menu of vegan snacks And that's in tribute to your mom and her roots. She grew up in Cuba.
Yeah.
And it's now serving a 7-course vegan tasting menu.
Yeah, this goes back to my being insane. you know, just basically like I was bored with the initial format of workshop because we weren't making enough food. And I also got lots of emails. They're like, hey, when are you opening Farm Spirit again, which was our tasting menu restaurant before? And I didn't want to open Farm Spirit again, but I said, oh, we could move forward with that. And the thing that's been cool is that when I first opened Workshop, I pretty much fell back into like the kind of style that we've been cultivating through Farm Spirit before, but now slowly creeping in are some more Latin elements. And so for me to be able to like do like a corn, like a sweet corn dessert that's like typical in Cuban cuisine, or doing like...
You mentioned a pasta de bocadito and a lion's mane empanizado.
Oh yeah, pasta de bocadito is like deviled ham paste, basically. But we did a vegan version of that. We made pasta de bocadito and put it in a vegan brioche that we did before. But also, what was the other one you said? The lion's mane empanizado?
Exactly.
Yeah. So like doing like something like, you know, like, yeah, adding those elements, still doing like a... Like
that's
a,
part
like,
of the tasting menu now.
Yeah, or? Like just have that be like one of the courses instead of doing it so... And I think at the end of the day where Workshop lands is kind of a fusion of like French technique, Cuban influence, and a whole lot of hippie in there too.
A true melting pot.
For sure.
Well, Aaron and Liz, thanks so much for talking with us about the new cookbook. As someone who grew up on Wonder Bread, Oscar Mayer bologna, and Hostess cupcakes, and TV dinners, it's good to find food that's healthy, humane, and delicious. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ken.
Thanks for having us.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show or would like to hear the longer, unexpurgated version, the director's cut you might call it if we had one, you can listen anytime, on demand, at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guests today, Aaron Adams and Liz Crane, authors of the new cookbook, Fermenter, DIY Fermentation for Vegan Fare from Sasquatch Books. You can find out more about Aaron and Fermenter the restaurant at fermenterpdx.com. And if our conversation made you curious about vegan fermented food, you can visit the restaurant at 1403 Southeast Belmont Street. And there's also the annual Portland Fermentation Festival coming up on Thursday, October 19th at the EcoTrust Building, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue in Portland. Liz is one of the festival organizers. You can learn more about Liz, the new Fermenter cookbook, and all her books at LizCrain.com. Just a note that KBOO is your community radio station, and we get over 80% of our funding from our members. It's our fall membership drive, so there's no better time to show your support for the station and programming like this by becoming a member yourself or renewing your membership. Just go online to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. All of us here at the station, even Jonesy himself, thank you for that. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, October 12th at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying... Sunshine, baby. Sunshine.